This is Austin Pace with BYU Idaho Radio, and I'm joined today by Jason S. Carroll, the director of the Family Initiative at the Wheatley Institute at Brigham Young University, and today's devotional speaker. He has been a faculty member in Brigham Young University's School of Family for the last 23 years. He and his wife, Stephanie, are the parents of five children and the grandparents of two grandchildren. Thank you for joining me today, Brother Carroll.
Thank you, Austin. I'm glad to be with you.
Awesome. So tell me a little bit about your position as the Director of Family Initiative. What exactly do you do?
So the Wheatley Institute at BYU is a research think tank. Our main purpose is to make sure that mission-critical research and scholarship gets focused on campus. So we have a family initiative, we have a religion and human flourishing initiative, and a constitutional government initiative. So I direct the family initiative, and I'm connected to my colleagues in the School of Family Life at BYU as well. So we do large research studies and look at different ways that marriages flourish and how to be effective parents and how strategies for teens to have emotional resilience. You know, these types of things are the type of work that we do.
So would you say that that kind of inspired your devotional address topic? Because your topic or the title of your address is called A True Temple Marriage. Would you say that kind of?
Yeah, the devotional remarks are definitely an intersection of the two parts of my life, right? I've been the marriage prep instructor at BYU for over the last 20 years or so. And so in that class, of course, being at a church university where we can blend the gospel with our professional learning, I've been teaching and emphasizing the teachings of our prophets and the foundations and doctrines of temple marriage. But at the same time, as a researcher, I bring in that relationship science, what I sometimes call the second witnesses, right? Our prophetic teachings are the primary witnesses. But we also see some really compelling second witnesses to the truths that are taught to us, and that those patterns actually create a unique kind of marriage that we can have a lot of confidence in being a really stable, enduring type of marriage, not just because of the gospel principles, which are the primary part, but I can walk through the different research parts, too, that show that these are the types of marriages that do really well and endure.
Right, and you kind of address that in your devotional address, and I want to talk about that a little bit later. But to begin your address, you start with counsel that President Nelson gave in his first public address as president and prophet of the church. He said, to begin with the end in mind. So why do you feel the need to include that as your first talking point in your address? And what is the significance of that teaching to you personally?
Isn't it remarkable, right? The first thing that President Nelson wants to do is not only to talk and teach about temples, but to actually do it from a temple, right? I think we will long remember President Nelson's time as our president and prophet, as this temple era, right, of how so much temple growth and emphasis. And as we talk about, and as I talk about in my remarks today, we need to be careful to not just see those as locations, that are not just buildings, right? The reason why President Nelson has been instructed by the Lord to do this is to open the blessings of temples to us. And so I start there because I think that beginning with the end in mind when it comes to marriage and family life, the temple and temple covenants and temple ordinances are really a way to make sure we come from that kind of correct starting point, so to speak.
Right, and you kind of tell a story of your friend John, who saw a picture of the temple in your home, and he was wondering, oh, how much did that cost you, right? And you said something just barely about seeing the temple as not only a building. So can you tell me a little bit about that story with John and the counsel that you gave him and told him about temples?
Yeah, so John was a friend of mine in graduate school, not a member of our faith, so a devout Christian in his own faith and belief, and very respectful. We had a lot of conversations about sharing our faith with one another, but wasn't familiar with temples. And so he saw that picture in our home and asked me what it was, and I told him that it was where my wife Stephanie and I were married. And again, he saw a location, and so he immediately went to, wow, how much does it cost to rent a wedding venue like that, a wedding chapel, you know, looking at the Salt Lake Temple? That's a pretty impressive-looking wedding chapel if you're thinking of it in those terms. But, yeah, the thing I help John, I try to teach with John and talk with him a bit, too, there's this idea of understanding. I'm a developmentalist, too, in my training. I work in developmental models. Usually when we learn about development, we learn about foundations and then the next stage and the next stage and the next stage. But it's also important to understand that development not only builds on its foundations, it hangs from its apex. And what I mean by that is if you go out to the end, you go out to the optimal development and you see what that is, and then you work backwards. If you do that, then you know that your developmental model, so to speak, or under perspective is anchored to the optimal. If not, you can veer in different directions. And I think that's exactly what President Nelson is saying, right, is that type of idea. Begin with the end in mind, anchor to that optimal end, and then work your steps backwards, right? So I was able to talk with John a bit about the ordinance of a celestial marriage, the new and everlasting covenant of marriage, what that means in our faith. And it triggered a very great conversation to talk about our beliefs and why temples are so sacred to us.
Right. And directly after that, you go on to say that, quote, a true temple marriage is a pattern or a design for marriage. In fact, the Proclamation on the Family teaches us that a true temple marriage is one that is established and maintained according to God's divine design for marriage and families. So can you elaborate a little more on that comment that you're going to make in your devotional address?
Yeah, I love that term and phrase from the Proclamation on the Family. It's the end of paragraph 7 of the Proclamation, uses that phrase of the divine design. That's really important for us to think about, right? I think often when it comes to marriage in particular, it's easy to think about marriage as only an end, right? It's why get married? Well, to be married. It's the end, so to speak, in and of itself. If we think about God having a divine design, marriage is not only an end, it is also a means, right? It's a purpose towards creating God's plan and purposes. Right. In fact, in my marriage preparation class and in the Eternal Families class that I teach and we talk about, we emphasize that in the creation, right, the importance of the creation of man and woman, but ultimately the culminating act of the creation was the creation of marriage so that the creation could continue. The creation wasn't intended to be an event. It's intended to be a process. We're not invited to be observers of the creation. We're invited to be participants in the creation, be co-creators with God. So when we start thinking in those terms of marriage and family as a divine means, right, it's this whole idea then of what is the purposes of our marriage? What are we going to accomplish? What is the how does this tie into God's plan? We start to see when we do this that it's not just that marriage and family is an important part of God's plan. Marriage and family is God's plan, right? So I think that dual understanding of both marriage as a divine means and marriage as a divine end gives us a powerful, unique understanding that's so very different than just marriage as a personal, private relationship between two people, of the couple, by the couple, for the couple, right? This is why tying into God's divine institution of marriage does give us some unique understandings that I think are deeply, deeply beneficial to how we can approach and establish and maintain flourishing marriages.
How have you seen, thinking in that light, bless your marriage with your wife?
There's a little part I'll share in today's devotional remarks, too, where I talk about the starting point of our marriage, right, and how we were taught during our sealing. We had the opportunity, and I shared the unique circumstances of how we ended up with Elder L. Tom Perry as our sealer. And he asked us questions about our kids, which seemed like at the time a bit odd. Here we are, a couple that's not even yet married, and he's asking us about our children. But he went on to teach and explain to us that we weren't just gathered together that day to participate in and for our families to witness marriage of a couple. We were there to create an eternal family. And so I think that's been so helpful to my wife, Stephanie, and I. We've reflected on that. We've tried to take that as a bit of a model and a pattern for our marriage, to just be mindful of how much beauty there is in marriage when you come together with these shared goals, this shared covenant path to do together as a couple. And so our marriage is so deeply blended now, as we're 30 years, you know, into our marriage, of parenting, of raising children, of sharing in that life's journey together. It does give marriage a deeper richness, more of a wholeness, and, as I was saying before, a purpose. It gives our partnership a purpose. And I think that's deeply unifying in a marriage relationship.
So you then go on to talk about how a lot of people today are concerned that marriage is fragile and unpredictable. And it's kind of just a hookup culture, mm-hmm. where you can be with someone for years, live with them, have kids with them, but they won't tie that knot of marriage. And to me, that's very interesting. So I want to ask you some of the same questions that you use in your address. They're kind of rhetorical questions.
Sure.
But you say, quote, "Is it true? Is marriage fragile and unpredictable?"
So for this one, I'm going to shift over a little bit. I'm going to go into my marriage researcher response on this, okay? Because that belief that marriage is fragile and marriage is unpredictable is based on some faulty assumptions, right? And I mentioned this a little bit in my remarks as well. As I've now taught over 10,000 students in marriage prep. I've been going at it long enough. And in every class, I've asked students, how many of you have heard that there's a 50% divorce rate in our culture? Every hand in every class goes up, okay? Now, little side note, the actual cultural statistic isn't quite 50% anymore. It's a little bit closer to 40%. But nonetheless, people have grown up with this idea that half of marriages don't work out. The problem is there's an assumption that the divorce rate is uniform. Every couple has the same risk and the same possibility, right? Nothing could be further from the truth. Not all marriages are created equally. They have different foundations, different motivations, patterns, priorities. Marriages can be very, very different from each other. And some are very fragile. Some have a 90% chance of coming apart. Others are so stable, so enduring, they have a 2% chance of coming apart, right? You put them all together in the same society, we get a 50% average, 40, 50% average. So the key then becomes, well, what are the stable ones? How do you make sure you have one of those stable, enduring marriages? And I always say to people when they say, well, marriage is unpredictable, I've worked for 30 years now in the field of research that's called marriage prediction research. We predict marital outcomes, and how well can we predict which couples will stay together, which ones won't, which ones will be happy, which ones won't, right? The marriage prediction models now are close to 90% in their accuracy. To marriage researchers, to marriage experts, to marriage counselors and therapists, there's no mysteries. There's no surprises. We know why and when couples come apart and when they don't. And the great, great news, in all of the marriage prediction work is the strongest, most important factors that predict the course of a marriage are agentive. They're controllable. They have to do with the things we set our hearts upon, the things we choose, the way we live. And as I try to show in my devotional remarks, they're remarkably lined up with the covenant path. If we live on that covenant path, we get all of these beneficial factors that create these very stable marriages. And we don't have to worry that the fragileness we might see in some people's marriages, celebrities' marriages, marriages in the broader culture, that's not our fate and it doesn't have to be. And even if, maybe I think sometimes some of the greatest fears are when we've experienced family disruption in our own homes, right? And so maybe our parents or people close to us, we've felt and experienced the impact of marriages that struggle or even come apart. But the research is also very clear. Even people with those situations in their background can go on to have tremendously flourishing, happy, enduring marriages if they'll choose the right patterns and directions of it. So that idea of a design, that idea of a kind of marriage, not only true in the proclamation on the family, it's absolutely true in the best cutting-edge research we have about couples and marriages.
And you did a research project that talked a little bit about the law of chastity, mm-hmm. and how couples that keep the law of chastity while they're dating are more likely to have a happy and full marriage. So can you tell me a little bit about that study?
Yeah, absolutely. That one, the definitive statement we can say, and it not only comes from the study we published last spring, but at the first of this study. And the great news is with my devotional remarks, I put links into all of these studies. So anything I mention as a study during my remarks, people can click on it and go look at it themselves, right? We also reviewed five other studies recently done in the last 5 years, all using different national data sources. So what I'm about to say actually comes from five studies, all kind of confirmed. Number of sexual partners before marriage is the strongest predictor we have of divorce in the prediction models. So this eat, drink, and be merry, you know, for tomorrow we get married, and this culture that we have, like you said, this hookup culture, this idea that it's good to gain sexual experience, it's this good thing to test the sexual chemistry in relationships. All of those are patterns, and cohabitation, right? We mentioned those are all patterns leading to where people today, on average, are entering marriage with multiple sexual partners prior to being married. Those people have much higher divorce risk. In fact, in the first 5 years of marriage, a person who marries and their spouse is their one lifetime sexual partner, the data shows, has about a 5% chance of divorce in the first 5 years. If you marry and have two or more sexual partners before you marry, the risk is about, the chance is about 30%. It's about six times higher in that kind of difference. Now, I always emphasize too when I share this finding, we did go in and do some sub-analysis, some detailed analysis. There is a repentance path in here. We do find a way. It's funny to say that, right? Research shows repentance is possible, but it does, and it's there. So I never want that statistic to ever be discouraging. If someone sees and wants to make a change, they regret some past behaviors and decisions, the evidence would show us that that path is very possible, but it does require significant change. It would require leaving that kind of hookup mindset. It would mean being more of a permanent, committed, it's a person-centered love rather than a trait-based attraction. That becomes a problem of hookup culture. There's really no permanence with one person. We become attracted to the traits and to the situation. A person-centered love is very different. So, but when those changes happen, and of course through the atonement of Jesus Christ, that's always possible, but very compelling to see that the law of chastity and reserving sex for marriage has been shown, not just in the BYU study, I always want to emphasize that, not just in the BYU Wheatley Institute, but by researchers who have no religious agenda or religious viewpoint, are finding in the other large data sets the exact same pattern. We called the title of that report The Myth of Sexual Experience, because there really is nothing that shows that living the law of chastity and reserving sexual relations for marriage is a strong protective factor of having a good marriage. It's not a risk at all. We don't miss out on anything by following that divine pattern from the Lord.
How do you think that those studies can or could influence this hookup culture today?
We would hope. There's always hope that those kind of ideas could cause, you know, the findings could cause people to pause and, you know, convert in their thinking, so to speak. And that may happen from time to time. I'm also deeply interested in just how these findings can help retention, if you will, right? Those of us who know gospel truths and spiritual truths. And I want to be clear, this isn't just for Latter-day Saints and for members of the church. We see this across world faiths. Chastity is a pattern taught by a number of world faiths. And so we live in a culture where people are increasingly being told, hey, that's not very smart. You're going to get married and not live together and test out the relationship first? Oh, do you know if you have sexual chemistry or not? You're going to get married and you don't know if you have sexual chemistry, right? So for people trying to live according to those faith patterns, they're the ones being told, well, that's foolish. The counsel of the prophets is going to lead you astray. You're going to be more likely to be unhappy in your marriage. You're going to be more likely to not have a satisfying intimacy in your marriage. You're going to be more likely to get a divorce because you didn't do these things. All of these are what I call myths. These are myths of marriage preparation. This has been a main area of my career for a number of time now. Cohabitation raises divorce risk, right? Sexual experimentation before marriage raises divorce risks. Pornography involvement raises divorce risks. So all of these become ways that I see the studies in a lot of ways too, just helping retain, giving a confidence to those of us who say, hey, you know what? What I learned in Sunday school actually works in the real world. So I'd love to convert some minds, but I'm also pretty invested in also helping people kind of retain and have confidence of the path that they've been taught by their parents, their church leaders, and others too.
Perfect. So further in your address, you ask a question that I think is super interesting, and I'd love to dive a little bit deeper into it.
Sure.
You ask, so what are the unique daily patterns of living that emerge from spouses cherishing and honoring their eternal marriage covenants?
And I mentioned a little bit here, too, a comprehensive answer to this, right? I mean, I have a tough time fitting it into a full semester marriage preparation class or into my Marriage Compass textbook that we use for the class. But yeah, we need to realize that what we're taught of how to live in a true temple marriage ties into the patterns of living, the things that we focus on. So it becomes priorities and patterns, right? Of how significant should a marriage be? How committed should we be to it? What a difference in commitment to think that we haven't just made a promise with another person, but we've actually made a covenant with God and with them. That's a different way to think about your commitment in marriage, right? Or to think about the doctrine of equal partnership that's taught to us in the Proclamation on the Family, has been taught by our prophetic leaders. Elder Suarez has a great talk from just a couple of years ago about eternal marriage and how we need to be side by side and making shared decisions together and doing that all together in a true kind of teamwork and partnership, and both spouses receiving revelation for the value of their marriage. I mean, that's just a beautiful image. So these become much more than just principles, right? How to handle conflict? How do we handle differences? How do we make sure we avoid contention? Don't slip into these patterns. These are the very things that the marriage research and marriage counselors, and they're working with people, and this is where they see these struggles come in. The mismanagement of conflict is the number one predictor of couples who slide into real struggles and occasionally divorce. How do we handle that? Well, if we're committed to avoiding contention, committed to being equal partners. So the Lord has really blessed us. None of us need to feel like we need to figure marriage out for ourselves. How do you do this, right? It's a real how-to model that our Father in Heaven gives us, and our prophetic leaders are teaching us. So again, being on the covenant path will teach us that, yeah, it's important to spend meaningful time with our spouse. It's important to forgive offenses and move on from things and not let them fester. It's important to come together and repair relationships when there's been struggle or difficulty. And there's unity that comes together when we have shared family and home worship and wholesome recreation and the things that we do. So the gospel gives us a very beautiful path and direction for couples to unite their marriages around and know that they'll be on the same page. So in that way, we do see just a number of patterns that emerge if we try to have true temple marriages that match up, again, very nicely with the relationship sciences that we see.
Right. So for newlyweds, what is your advice to them then with all the research that you've done, with your knowledge of the gospel, what is your advice to newlyweds to having that relationship?
My students have heard me say for years, if I had to boil my class down to one lesson and I could only do one lesson, I'd teach them equal partnership. I think it's the great principle that can guide through dating. It can guide through marriage. Do you see an equal partnership relationship emerging? Two people, right? I've used the quote so much that I can actually cite it. I can't cite a lot of quotes, but President Hinckley has a beautiful quote about equal partnership, right? And he talks about how there's neither inferiority nor superiority in the marriage relationship. The husband, the wife doesn't walk ahead of the man doesn't walk ahead of the woman. They walk side by side as eternal partners, right, on this eternal journey. That's a beautiful metaphor to hold in mind and to see that in dating. Is that emerging, right? If you've got that and a relationship's maybe becoming exclusive and trying to decide if there's a future to it, if you see an equal partnership relationship and a disciple marriage coming out of that, there's real foundations there. And then my advice to newlyweds would be, make sure that stays at that anchor. Keep the Savior as a focal point inside of the marriage. And if you'll commit to the covenant path, if you'll commit to those daily, weekly, monthly rituals of prayer, of scripture study, of coming together around that, it'll create that kind of anchor. And it'll help navigate those kind of life ups and downs that naturally happen and occur, and the relationship just has a richness to it. You're not left just kind of on the feelings of love. Feelings are great. We all want them. But mature love teaches us that it's much more than just the feeling. Our attitudes and choices and priorities is also a deep form of love. So it's not just falling in love. It's also choosing love. And then the most important is mature love is also doing love. So our loving behaviors and actions, again, that can be very consistent. Those things don't have to shift and flow. And in fact, when feelings go down a little bit, what a mature understanding to have to say, hey, my feelings of love are low, so I need to do some choosing of love and some actions of love right now. That'll help restore those feelings rather than telling ourselves, I don't feel it, so I'm not going to do it. Too many young couples let their marriages be based on, right? They kind of hold their relationship hostage, so to speak, by the mood of the relationship. If I'm in the mood, then I'll do these things, right? Our commitments need to be deeper than that. Our commitments need to be deeper to our marriage to say, let's not let the feelings, moods and feelings move up and down a little bit, but our choices, our priorities, our actions can be very, very stable. And that helps our relationships have a really enduring foundation.
So for somebody to get to that point, what advice do you give then to those who are single, who are in that dating stage?
Well, I wrap up my devotional today. You'll hear my little piece of advice, and I'll share it now. I caution, right, this idea of begin with the end in mind is a beautiful teaching that is really important with the big vision of marriage and family life. I don't recommend it as a motto for first dates, right? I think sometimes we put too much pressure on first dates, and they're such a big deal. And so people are often even reluctant to ask someone on a date. It almost feels like it's some sort of quasi proposal, some sort of quasi commitment. We want to create, and everybody on campus can do this together, right? And all young adults throughout the church can do this together to create this shared dating culture that just allows for those first dates to be first dates. Just let people get to know each other, meet each other, spend some time with each other on a one-on-one interaction. It's so beneficial. It's so fruitful. But sitting there on a first date, trying to decide if is this a marriage-ready relationship? Could I marry this person? It's very counterproductive, right? It's like I say in my remarks, it's like turning a jar lid the wrong way. You're trying to get it to open, but you might be actually making it tighter. It just makes weird pacing and weird patterns of things. So I'm a big believer that if we will kind of lower, and President Oakes and others have been emphasizing this. I quote some of his counsel again about, you know, we need to make sure that this isn't a big thing. And it's not just between the two people. It needs to also be between their friends, everybody in the YSA ward, right? We joke down at BYU. It's probably the same here a little bit. We call it the three-date rule sometimes. And if you don't declare if you're a couple by the time you're going on a third date, the YSA ward will declare for you, right? They're oh, you're a couple because you've been on a third date. And like, no, we're just trying to get to know each other. And so there's kind of this push. Everybody's heard the counsel about be careful about too much hanging out and go on dates. There's the other problem, too, is relationships getting exclusive too fast, too quickly, which actually makes people less willing to ask out on dates because if they feel like I ask someone on a date, it's like I'm asking them to be my boyfriend or my girlfriend. So it just reduces all of our dating culture. So my main advice is hold that as the big aspiration. It's in the back of our mind. It's always something that should be important to us. But for those initial dates, let it be low key. Let it be less of an emphasis. I think we'd be amazed at how naturally more relationships will blossom and move towards commitment, engagement, and marriage in time if we let there be a less stressful start point of that and just let it be a little bit more of a chance to go on dates.
Yeah. A couple weeks ago, President and Sister Meredith had a campus-wide date night. Yeah. And it was awesome. At the very beginning, they was, I don't want to say it was like a devotional, but it was kind of like a Q&A where they gave their tips on dating and the dating culture because, you know, it has turned into that. The dating culture is all right. If you ask somebody out, okay, you're wanting them to be your boyfriend or girlfriend. And that, for me, of course, makes it really hard to, like, ask somebody on a date because I'm like, I just want to get to know you. Let's just have some fun on the first date and we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, we can't and we shouldn't. We can't determine. And so it just really, you can just see how it's just counterproductive. So actually by stepping back a little bit on the culture with our early dates, actually paradoxically will go the other direction, right?
Right.
So it doesn't feel that way, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm always mindful of that. I'm always careful, like, don't misunderstand what I'm saying here. We need to begin with the end in mind. We want to think about the temple. Marriage is what matters. Everyone should have that as the deep desire of their heart. You'll actually have better chance of that. And the key and the reason why it's so great that we're talking about this, I mean, this would be great if you and I were just talking about this alone. But to do this, the real power is going to come if we collectively do this. Everybody shares in this and says, hey, on our campus, this is how it is. And I hope you guys all, I know you know this, but I'm just going to state it. I hope you all know how awesome the Merediths are. They are just the greatest. I just think so highly of them. And so I'm glad that was a good success. And I hope it's something that the campus would do more and more of, because that's exactly what we need, is to create this environment that's just, hey, just a date. It's just a date. Slow down. It's just, and if you can't get all of campus, right, it's going to maybe takes time for all of campus to change. You can at least gather the people closest to you, right? Gather your roommates, grab your friends, your siblings, your mission buddies, whatever, and just say, hey, look, between us, we don't do that to each other, right? Someone goes on a date, right? They don't need to come home from that first date and, oh, well, we were going through the bridal magazines and we think you'd look like, you know, oh, no. Just, hey, how'd your date go? Hey, that's great. Go on a second date. They go on a third date. The minute the friend group and the roommates start peppering about, where's this going? Is this... That's actually counterproductive. So, you know, pinky swear promise with each other that you're not going to do that to each other, that among our friends, we just let each other go on dates. It's one of the best things you could do for your friends and people close to you.
Right. I think that's fantastic advice. Thank you so much.
You bet.
That was Jason S. Carroll, the director of the Family Initiative at the Wheatley Institute at Brigham Young University, and today's devotional speaker. Thank you again for joining me, Brother Carroll.